Hi everyone and welcome to our podcast today. My name is Maureen Egbe.
And I'm Henry Stewart. And today on the podcast we have Don Monkhouse, who's written two books, F Plan B and Mind Your Effing Business.
Well, so why does it make you laugh saying that, Henry?
And he's built two hosting businesses from zero to 30 million in 5 years. So that's an interesting.
Pretty impressive.
So, Maureen, what's your joy at work?
Well, my joy at work has to do a bit with work this time round. All right. And it was because we met with CEO Jeremy Cook of Action with Racial Equality.
Yeah.
Okay. And for me, what the joy was that new connection. You know, whatever you do, it's about making new connections, meeting new people, and especially when they are doing work that's really important. You know, so it was a joy having a conversation.
He's done some really impressive work with black young men in working in financial services and other places.
Yeah, and he's working hard, you know. So it was a pleasure. And it's that encouraging connection, collaborations, and hopefully getting to learn more about people that are on the same plane as you, you know, looking to achieve the same things as you. So that was my joy. It was a great conversation that we had. And Henry, what's been giving you joy?
Well, actually, this is possibly not joy at work. I have left London after 33 years. I've sold our house and I've moved to Somerset. And the great thing here is I get to cycle. I get to cycle without traffic lights, without cars. I get to, you know, go up hills and things like that. But I do plan to come back to London.
I was going to say.
I do plan to come back to Stoke Newington. You know, everyone out here says, why would I ever go back to London? But yes, you know, London is just the greatest city in the world, isn't it?
I don't know. I prefer a beach, me. But yes.
So, Dom, you have built hosting businesses from zero to 30 million in 5 years, two hosting businesses, haven't you?
Yep, in the UK, we have.
That's amazing.
That is amazing.
100 odd employees both times.
So, yeah, I think you know what you're talking about.
Well, I think so. I think if I'd done it once, maybe I might have just been there or it would have been an accident. But, you know, did that twice. And in between, we did a turnaround with another business that had a net promoter score of, I think, -7 when we arrived, and we got it to +55. It was losing £65,000 a month when I got there. So we had 3 months to get it to cash flow break even. Otherwise, it was gone. And a couple of years after, I spent 2 years fixing it. A couple of years after I left, they sold it for 26 million. So that was another sort of
that's impressive
turnaround in the middle of those two growth businesses. So I like to think I know what I'm talking about. Now, some people would agree with you. Others might disagree, but I do have some skills that I like to share.
So let's get into this. I mean, we've already touched, because I was talking to Henry beforehand. I was like, oh, scaling up is your superpower. But I want to take you back, because you've also written two books. And one of them is called Mind Your Effing Business. And you say that reading this will bring you back to some joy in your work. And you know that's what we're all about. So please tell us more about that.
Well, before I do, I was at a conference in the US recently, and they said, has anybody written a book? So I put my hand up, and they said, what is the name of your book? And I said, Mind Your Effing Business. And then when the notes from the conference came out, it said, Dominic Monkhouse declined to tell us the name of his book. I meet entrepreneurs. So I probably coach entrepreneurs in a particular part of the journey mostly, which is sort of 50 to 500 as they're trying to 10x their business. That for me is the sweet spot. And I think about it as a startup, it looks more like a basketball team. It's got a few really gifted individuals, and then there's the rest of the team who are being carried by a few gifted individuals. But then as you become a scale-up business, you need to have a team, and business is a full contact sport. And I meet people who, the entrepreneurs, now in a position where they're doing work that doesn't bring them joy. They're doing things that are not their genius. They're doing work, 90% of the work doesn't put them in flow. And I can get on a call with an entrepreneur and they say, things like, I just hate my job. I hate this company. I'm failing. And I go, you can't be failing. You know, you've taken this business to £12 million or £15 million or £30 million or whatever it is. And they go, yeah, I know, but I just hate it. I've had people ring me up and just burst into tears because they just hate it so much. And I say, but you're the CEO, you could do anything. And they say, what do you mean? And I say, well, you don't have to do anything you don't enjoy. And they just go, what do you mean? Like in their mind, the job of CEO, and Rachel Turner's written a book called The Founder Survival Guide. And she said, look, to start a business, you have to be a warrior. And then as the business scales, you have to be an architect. And this sort of thing about being a sort of master jack of all trades, and then they think they need to make the trains run on time. And they're playing out of position and they hate it. And it's like, well, stop doing it then. And they're like, oh, can I do that? And I go, yes, you have my permission. And they're just like, whether they hire me for coaching or not, it doesn't matter. But I feel like they get relieved. And so some of the things, you know, lots of the tech CEOs I coach are technology founders. And in the book, I talk about, you don't have to pay salespeople commission. And they go, you don't? And I go, nope. And they go, why has nobody told me this before?
Now, tell us about that, because that is a very unusual request, but I'd love it. So why don't you have to pay salespeople commission?
So here's the thing. At a meta level, I think salespeople are just people. And so I think the last couple of decades, the best author on sales has been a guy called Matt Dixon, who wrote The Challenger Sale, and he's written a great new book called The Jolt Effect. And I had him on the podcast, and I said, look, Matt, help me understand this, because I've gone looking for research to try and see. Now, there's two bits of this. One is, if you pay people to do piecework, right, you know, I'm going to put bottles in a box on a production line and you pay me piecework, you can increase the productivity of piece workers by paying them per thing. But if it's cognitive, all of the research says if you pay people to try and do more cognitive work, they do less cognitive work. And I think consultative selling, if selling is I'm going to persuade you to do a thing that you weren't planning to do this morning whilst brushing your teeth, I think that's selling, then that's cognitive. It's not transactional. I'm not helping you buy. I'm actually going to persuade you to do a thing. Well, all the research says you pay people to do that, they do less of it. And so it's paying salespeople commission where it's not a transactional sale. So things like estate agency, I think that's transactional, right? Yeah, probably pay them money. They might work harder. And also the Harvard Business Review article on the anatomy of a salesperson said about 20% of the population are greedy and therefore they are intrinsically money motivated. So you've got these two things that come together in the past. It all used to be transactional and some people are greedy. And so when you think of a salesperson, often people's in their minds, they go, they're coin operated, they're greedy, you pay them money, they work harder. Look, if paying for something worked, every single restaurant you'd ever been into where you tipped, well, the service in every restaurant and every pub in the world should be amazing because you're tipping them, except it's still not. It's even when the person gets like 20 or 30% of their salary from tips, most of them are still rubbish. And, you know, 85% of salespeople, if paying commission worked, the 85% of salespeople who never hit their quota would actually hit quota, right? But then when you look at the 15% of people who achieve quota, they don't do it for the money at all. They do it for the status and they do it for the influence and they do it for self-esteem reasons. So when you say to people, you don't have to do it, they go, oh, right. Okay. So all of those things where the salesperson sells the wrong customer, the wrong product for the wrong reasons, all that goes away. The jealousy and envy inside the organization, because the salesperson wasn't the only person who won the deal. There was this whole team of people who helped the deal. They don't get paid money. So they look at the salesperson and they go, you're talentless. All you do is talk and you're overpaid. And they go, I don't have to do that. Oh, that's genius. Brilliant. Sign me up for that. Now, you are it is slightly challenging because in lots of places, if you don't pay commission, then how would you attract the talent? Because there is an expectation on behalf of the talented people that you're going to pay them. But I work in IT, and most of the IT people who we would be looking to hire into a sales role, A players, they're in a job, they're not looking. So I'm going to have to get them to leave a job where they're already being successful to come and work for me. They're being paid commission somewhere else. So I'm going to have to pay them a guarantee. That's likely to be 6 or 12 months guaranteed commission. So I'm already paying them just a salary for the first 12 months. So why wouldn't I then do that and then just pay them a salary in year 2 and year 3 and year 4? And then people say, well, how would I manage them? And I go, Well, you don't pay the receptionist commission and she still answers the phone, and you don't pay the developer's commission and they still manage to write code. In fact, if you paid the developer's commission, they'd write shorter lines of code, wouldn't they, so that you would pay them more. Oh, that would be like salespeople selling the wrong thing to the wrong person for the wrong reason. Oh, it just, and so I just think I can't, Matt Dixon said, Dom, I can't find, there's no evidence to support the fact that paying commission gets good salespeople to work harder. So don't do it.
So you're a big fan of pre-approval, which which as you know, we're a big fan of as well. So tell us how you did it with Rackspace in terms of maternity pay.
Well, Henry, I met you whilst we were both competing in the Management Today Service Excellence Awards. I met you during that. We also competed side by side in Great Places to Work and Best Companies Awards. And for a while, certainly at Peer One, I gave out the Happiness Manifesto as a staff employment handbook because I didn't have anything else to give people. And so I remember reading that whilst I was at Rackspace and chatting to you. And you said, but do you pre-approve stuff? And it's like, oh, no, people are bringing it to me. Right. And it's, I don't want to approve things. Like, that sounds like detail to me. And I have a phobia for detail. And also, I remember being at a conference where you said, think about the best work you've ever done in your life. And everyone's thinking about it. And was any of that directed by a manager? Nobody put their hand up. So it's like, we don't. And so it's like, so when you say it, it seems so simple. It's like, nobody does their best work. And so often managers are feeling like they have to earn their keep by, I don't know, interfering or making better any work that their subordinates have done. So Rackspace, we had a very simple purpose. It was fanatical support, which was also our sort of marketing strapline. And we had a BHAG, big, hairy, audacious goal or mission to be the Ritz-Carlton of the IT services world. And some of the team came to see me. So we were owned by an American business headquartered in Texas. Now, I think I'll get these countries wrong, but you know, it's like, is it Sudan and Eritrea and the United States are the only three countries in the world without paid paternity leave? It's something like that. I mean, it's all paid paternity or paternity, right? They just, you get a week off if you're lucky. And so as the company had come to the US and we'd put in place our pay and benefits, we only paid statutory maternity pay at the time. And so the young ladies came to see me, and like, they weren't at that point married or expecting children, but they said, we've had a look at this and it doesn't seem very fanatical to us. And I said, you're right. It doesn't, sounds rubbish. Hadn't occurred to me. That's my male bias. I said, why don't you have a look at the sort of companies that we talk to or compete with in the great best places to work or great places to work, best company stuff. And tell me what maternity pay would that for you guys would be, you know, fanatical. And it can't break the bank, so it can't be ridiculous. But whatever you go away and discuss and approve and budget, we'll implement it. So they went away and they did some analysis and they looked at what people had done. So it wasn't a blank check. They had some guardrails. They went away, they looked at other people and they said, okay, maybe we wouldn't be the best, but certainly at the minute we're the worst. So this is where we think we'd want to play. And I went, okay, approved, done.
That's an incredible degree of trust, isn't it? You know, most CEOs wouldn't trust their people in that way.
Well, I think there are some things you shouldn't skimp on. I mean, at Peer One, one of the things we decided to do was we had a look at we had about 700 employees and we looked at where were we paying? And we had this view that we should be paying sort of mid-market, you know, sort of 50th percentile. That doesn't make you very attractive from a pay perspective. But if we wanted to go to 75th percentile, it was going to cost us another $500,000 in annual payroll. So we said, actually, we'll leave it at mid-market. We'll every 6 months, we'll make sure everybody's salaries are mid-market and we'll do a true up. If people are slipping behind, we'll true up. But we're going to try and be top 5% for benefits, which was actually much cheaper. And so I think things like, you know, decent maternity pay, you know, what other, and like when people put on their benefits on a job ad, you know, 28 days. It's like, that's statutory. That's not a benefit. The government have written in law that you must give people 28 days. It is not a benefit if it's 28 days. In fact, don't put it on because people know you're mean, right? So it's like your benefits have to be something that you're not forced to pay employees. And therefore, you know, having a list of things that you can say you do, I think attracts people to potentially apply for a job with you. And you, and you're marketing to both prospective employees and prospective customers all the time. So what can you do?
So building on that, so how would you say, what's the best way to write an awesome job ad, you know, to get the right people?
So I read a book, I think, called Hiring for Attitude. And there's a chapter at the back about writing a job ad. And I found it really helpful. So if you go on Indeed or somewhere and you look at a job ad, 99.9% of all the job ads will be the same format. And the format will be, we are amazing as a company, paragraph one. This job requires the following things, you know, master's degree in nuclear physicists, even if you just want to be a cleaner, you know, like massive over things you need. And then at the bottom, it says, and here's what you get, you know, you get a salary and you get 28 days and like not much else. And you think, if you took somebody on a date and you took that as your, you know, format for your date, you'd be talking about yourself until the main course arrived. I think it would be reasonable if your date nipped to the loo and never came back. I mean, it's like narcissism and you know, it's just awful. So I'm trying to hire, I'm always trying to hire A players. And my definition of A player is the top 10% of available talent for a given job in a given location in a given salary. Now, these people aren't out of work. Right. So they, what you're trying to do is you're trying to get them on a Sunday afternoon where they're, or a Sunday evening where they're having a scan at a job board and they're thinking it's Monday tomorrow and they're just not feeling any deep sense of joy, or they've had a shitty week and they're frustrated. They've got a glass of wine in their hand. They're probably, the TV's playing in the background, and you just need to snag their attention with something. So you need the job title is probably a bit dull, because if you try and come up with snazzy job titles, then they don't appear in the search because they're searching for the job title they currently do, salesperson or something. But then that first paragraph has to be something that talks to them. And so, you know, I've written job ads for salespeople where it says something like, you're the best salesperson in your company. But honestly, when was the last time you learned anything from your manager? And people people send me their CV and they go, how did you know? I go, well, I talk to the people who are here and they're the type of thing. So what you do is you go and talk to your employees and you say, what frustrated you where you were before and what doesn't frustrate you here? And you put that in your first paragraph. You say, I've got the freedom to make decisions. My manager's not a dickhead. Nobody shouts at me. I don't know. I don't have to work with perverts. I whatever it is, whatever it might be that, you know, I can bring my dog to work. I don't know. But it's something in that first paragraph that says, why should somebody read the rest of the ad? And then you say, if this is you, then this is why this would be a joyful role for you. And then these are the criteria to be excellent in the job. And frankly, I don't say anything about the company because there's an email address or there's a web address and they can go and look on our website. So why would we repeat something that we've written better somewhere else? And what you're trying to do is you're just trying to get them to send you a CV.
But it sounds more than that. It's almost like you're trying to tap into them. You know, you're getting to the heart of things rather than just talking about the business.
Let me give you an example, which isn't me, right? So I've coached Hazel Pulley, who's the CEO of Excelsior Matt, which is a multi academy trust up in Birmingham. When they gave me a call a few years ago, they had, I think, three primary schools in inner city Birmingham. And she said, I could really do with some help setting a strategy. And so they wanted to get, I think, to six schools. And we came up with their BHAG, which was to be world famous for innovation in education. And I said to Jonathan, who's the COO, I said, how do you feel about that? He said, that scares me shitless. He said, we're a few little primary schools in Birmingham. Like, how are we going to be world famous for anything? This is ridiculous. Anyway, I said, well, if that was going to be true, what would have to be true? And they said, we would have to have teachers that thought that that was true, that made that happen. And I said, okay, so you need some better people. And they said, we need better people. And I said, well, where are you at the minute? And they said, well, when we put a job ad out, we get like 30 CVs, which are all rubbish. And so they on the job ad, they said, look, we're on a mission. This is our mission. These are our values as a business. If this sounds like the type of school that you want to teach in, you should send us the CV. The next time they put up a job ad, they had 300 CVs. And so what's interesting about them is they've got about 6% turnover of teachers. So they have to pick their head teachers and deputy heads really carefully because that has a massive impact. They can't pay people any more money. So as a team, all they can do is lead differently. And they've transformed those schools. They now have 7 schools in the mat. And so they came down recently for another sort of strategy refresh because they'd managed to reach their 3-year goal. And they have adopted some, I think, simple things from business, you know, like having a plan and having some values and sharing that mission and the values and the behavioral framework. And they've adopted the culture canvas as a way of bringing that behavioral framework to life. And they use a tool to measure staff happiness called Friday Pulse. And all of those things combined have just had a fantastic impact on the teachers and the children and the outcomes in those schools. It's been brilliant.
Now, you talk about A players. I like to think that everybody can be good at something. Not everybody can be good at anything, but everybody can be good at something.
That's right. Let me give you an example. Blackpool Beach Donkeys are fantastic at taking children up and down the sand. It doesn't matter what you spend on them or what aspirations you and they have for them, they're never going to win the national.
Okay, but the donkey national, I'm going to say.
maybe. It but depends. I hear you. So, because Henry and I have joked or argued about this a number of times before, I think Henry has a bigger heart than I do. He desperately wants everybody to be amazing at. Well, I agree. Everybody could be great at something. There are some people where I think I have no idea what you're going to be great at. Like, I've looked hard. The lights must be off in the cupboard because there's nothing there. But there must be something. There must be something. I, on the other hand, have got a job that needs to be filled by somebody who's amazing at it. And I think there's an overlap between, you know, what you are naturally gifted at. If there is a 60% or more overlap between what you're naturally gifted at and the job you have to do, the work can put you in flow, right? So I think, sadly, most people have jobs that don't put them in flow at all. They have jobs where they turn up and they grind and they get paid and they go home pretty miserable. McKinsey did a 10-year study of executives, and they looked for executives who were in flow. And they found that those people where their job put them in flow 60% or more of the time, they were 500% more productive. They managed to get more work done on Monday than those who were grinding got done by Friday. And you think, huh, okay, but maybe these people sort of are random that wouldn't work at a company level or a team level, surely. And so they didn't. There was another study that they did, which I really liked, which was drug development in pharma. And so they looked at all of the data they had because they're big in pharma. So they looked at all the data they had about team performance around the world. And you patent a molecule, and you then have 8 years to get it through clinical trials and get your money back. And then it becomes generic. And so getting it to market quickly saves you a fortune helps you make the money because it's cost you a couple of billion dollars to get to this point. What they found was that 85% of the teams thought they were above average. So 85% of them had no clear external benchmark for their performance, is how I read that. The top 1% were 10x better than average. They got a drug to market 500 days quicker than average. And so that was worth a fortune to their companies. And then sort of the next 2, 3, 4, 5% were 5x better than average. And so, you know, that if you can get people to be in flow and you get teams in flow, then 10x is possible. And I think that's what A players are. I think A players are 5 to 10 times more productive than B players, and they don't cost you any more money. Just not very common. So you have to recruit really hard to
isn't it also the case, though, that when you have a decent culture, you get more A players, or the established staff become more A players?
Yes. And our mutual friend Moira Clark did a study for, I have to be careful what I say because I've told her I won't reveal who she did the work with. So she did the work for a UK financial services institution, shall we say, and that was sort of controlling for the demographics. They took the manager from the best performing branch and they moved him to the worst, and nothing happened. And it was only when they moved a third of his team over with him that this flip happened. And you remember there's a book that's been out. It's an Indian IT outsourcing book, Employees First, Customers Second. And so he talks about this fence sitters. And he says, you know, once you've got critical mass in the believers, the fence sitters get off the fence and join the believers. And I think that's where you get this sort of cultural shift where to survive, you either have to leave because you're not prepared to do it, or you could do it, and the sort of the culture carries you, and you start to care, and you start to give a shit.
Yeah, because if you're micromanaged and told what to do, you're never going to get an A player, are you?
No, they just leave because they go. You've asked me to do something which is ridiculous, and so why would I? I'm not prepared to do that. I could get a job anywhere. I'm going to go by. You know, if I'm working with HR teams, they sort of say, oh, we've got this metric, which is staff turnover, and we want it to be lower. And I go, no, you don't. And they say, no, we want it to be like, you know, 10% or something. I said, no, you don't. You want it to be like 30%. And they say, why? I said, well, because you want to absolutely understand who the A players are, and you want none of them to leave, and you should be mortified if any of them leave. But you're not going to get it right 100% of the time. Even if you adopt something like top grading as a methodology, you're only going to hire A players correctly 85% of the time. So you're going to have 15% churn of the people you hired in the first 12 months. I mean, I was with a client recently, and depressingly, of the people they'd hired in the previous 12 months, 25% were A's, 50% were B's, 25% were C's, and they'd already left. But they had this chunk of people, and I make a distinction between a B and a B plus. Like, if you think about 1 to 10, a C is sort of 1 to 6. You spot them, you're going to get rid of them. Although they might be in the wrong role, or they might have the wrong manager. So, you know, it's not necessarily they're being fired. A 7 is a B, right? And they are inconsistent. They're a culture fit as well, right? So some days you go, that was amazing. What did they do? Did they get sleep? Did their kids not annoy them? Did the dog not wake them up? Did they have their breakfast? But today they were amazing. And then the next day you go, oh no, they're shit again. Just like, but not consistently bad enough to fire them. Just like, you just go like, what were they thinking? Why did they send that email? Why did they do that? Like, or why did they forget to do that? And then you've got B pluses who, if with some coaching, could be A's. And then you've got A's, and A's are a joy to work with. They say, Henry, I've just done this thing. And you go, I didn't ask them to do that. That is amazing. They knew what needed to be done and they did it. Oh, that is a joy. Thank you. Brilliant. And they go, oh, no problem. And then they do it again the next day. And you go, I love working with these people. It's just like, I go in every day thinking they'll do something today that will put a smile on my face and a smile on the face of other people in the office and a smile on the face of our customers. And I remember we were working with Simon, a CEO, a couple of years ago. And at the end of 2 days on the farm, he sat there and he looked at his team and he went, that's a lot of stuff we need to fix. How much of this stuff on our list of things to fix would we not have to fix if all of our people were A players? And there was a quiet moment, and then somebody went, none of it. And that's it. They had come to the conclusion that if they could replace everybody in the organization was an A player, all of the symptoms they were battling as a leadership team would actually go away.
Well, I do like to think that we have mainly A players that are happy, because I don't make any decisions. Everything gets done at the front line.
I actually feel like I need to canvas for the poor bees. You know, we need to help the poor bees. But a question that is really standing out for me at this moment in time is, I want to know more about you, about what gives you joy and what gives you joy in the work that you do.
Well, do you know what? This coaching malarkey is, it's like completely accidental that I'm here. So my daughter is 10 in May, which will be 10 years since I left Pier 1. And when I left Pier 1, we'd sold it in 2013 and I left in 2014. And I thought, I won't immediately loop back and get another job as a CEO of a tech company flying around the world and working 7 days a week. I'll do some consulting, maybe get some non-exec jobs, you know, spend some time with the kids. And then when the kids are at school, I'll get a proper job again instead of this part-time messing about stuff. And then it turned out that I really enjoy it. And the joy I get is similar to, I used to, when I was interviewing at Pier 1 and Rackspace and IT Lab and stuff, I'd meet somebody at interview and I'd be there thinking, you're amazing. In my head, I'm going, you're amazing. Mm-hmm. You have no idea how good you are. You're an A player and you're humble and you can't see it. But I know if we hire you, we can put all of these challenges in front of you. And maybe in 3 or 4 years' time, I'm thinking how many levels? You could probably go 3 or 4 levels up in this organization. And so, you know, being able to propel people forward, or, you know, I had a guy who, it's like changing lives. I had a guy apply, and Lee had applied for a job, and he'd handwritten his CV in a pages that he'd ripped out of a spiral notebook. And it was the least professional CV you have ever seen in your life, written with biro. And, you know, he went for an interview for the, in the data center, and Mike rang me and he said, I've just had this kid in. And look, we can't hire him, but he said, because he doesn't have the skills, but he said at the end of the interview, he said, look, I know you're not going to hire me, but can I come and work for free on a Saturday and Sunday so you can train me? And then when I know enough, you'll hire me. And I thought, I love that. So I said, send this kid in, to send him up to see me. So he came over and he was shaking. He couldn't speak because I was the managing director and he'd never met anyone so important. And so I said, do you play pool? And he said, yeah, play pool. I went, okay, let's get some beers out the fridge. So we had a couple of beers. We played pool. I broke, he cleared. But whilst he was playing pool and thrashing me, he was able to speak. So I chatted to him and we hired him. And so, you know, he came in, no qualifications, nothing. When I left 3 years later, he was in part of our IT security team and he had qualifications. And he said to me, Dom, you've changed my life. And so that ability to do what I love doing and change people's lives brings me joy. And I have the same with CEOs. You know, they ring me up and they say, I'm just stuck. And I don't know what to do next. And I've tried, because frankly, nobody rings me up if they're not stuck. I mean, they only ring me up if they're like, I've read all the books, I've done some stuff. I've been sharing my frustration with somebody and they've told me I should ring you. You might be able to help me. And then, you know, you do some work with somebody and you just help them come up with a plan and unlock whatever future they're seeking. It's fab.
So tell me, what are your three tips for a happy workplace, Dom?
Do you know what? There was a thing on EO.com. Somebody wrote a blog which said 85% of your employees should be plodders because then they won't get hired by your competitors. And it's like that type of stuff just makes my head explode. It's like, it's like Jim Collins, like get the right people on the bus, then work out what the destination is. That, to me, is like, I have to say, I'm probably at the abdicate end of delegation. And so if I don't have good people, I brief really badly. Like I'm super vague. My expectations are really high. If I don't have A players, they don't live very long. But if I do have A players, they go, I can sort of intuit what he wants. And then they come back to me, like Irene, who does our marketing. I'll sort of say, I've been looking at this thing. I saw this thing. Here's a screenshot of a thing. We should do that thing. And like, she'll come back a couple of weeks later in a one-to-one and she'll go, what about that? And I go, oh, that's way better than that thing that they had. That's fantastic, genius. And she goes, good. I thought you'd like that. And it's like, you know, it's just, you just have pace and people doing what they love doing. It's just a joy.
Well, thank you very much.
Maureen, Henry, it's been an absolute delight, a pleasure as ever, a joy.
Well, I hope we were amazing in your eyes after what you've just said.
A players to a man.
Yeah, there's a lot in there. And I do understand about the A's. And I know that you've got your thoughts around the A's. But I like the fact of that, just remembering that when you're scaling up, that you don't have to stick to what you're doing. Think about what it is that gives you joy and do more of that, not getting stuck. And then for your people, just getting out of the way, that second point that you made, you know, get out of their way so that they can do and be the best that they can at what they do.
Yeah, absolutely. I love the idea that salespeople don't need commission. I love, you know, all this stuff he did that says about pre-approval, you know, which is obviously what we do. And it was intriguing, that bit about when he talks to chief executives and they say, and he says, you know, you don't need to do with all that. You don't need to do that detailed work, which, you know, I guess in the early days of Happy, I did do all that work, but now, you know, I don't.
But tell me, for you, what was it about that? Was that about it's your baby? You started this business, so therefore you felt that you needed to make sure that you were hands-on still, or?
I guess I did in the early days. I guess I did, but, you know, and I had a big ego, you know, I had a, you know, I thought I was the best at everything, you know, and I realise now that I'm not. I realise now, you know, that a lot of other people are better at things than me. So I, you know, I've managed to step back and let people do their stuff.
Get out of their way.
Yeah, get out of the way. And the interesting thing about, you know, as I say, I like to think that everyone is good at something, because there was someone here, you know, back in the early 2000s who wasn't great at Happy, but he then went on to be the best salesperson for an estate agent in South London, you know. And so that's what I like to think, that everybody can be good at something.
So even though they're not an A in your place, they can be an A somewhere else. I actually do believe that a B can become an A given the right circumstances.
As long as, yeah, as long as you have the right culture, the right, you know, as long as you let them decide, you know, their own decisions and that kind of thing. Yeah.
Excellent.
So check out happy.co.uk
and let's continue creating joy at work.